Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Welcome to the Sydney Institute. Thanks for dropping along tonight, where we have the Reverend Bruce Ballantyne-Jones and the Reverend Andrew Semple. They're well known to many of you, but I will introduce them. Now, Bruce Ballantyne-Jones is here on the occasion of the publication of his book, Inside Sydney, An Insider's View of the Changes in Politics in the Anglican Diocese of Sydney, 1966 to 2013, and Anne's got some copies of the book available after. And the Reverend Andrew Semple is, of course, the rector of St. James Anglican Church in Sydney. So the topic for the discussion tonight is Sydney Anglicans. Bruce Ballantyne-Jones will lead off. He'll be followed by Andrew Semple, then we'll have questions and discussion and conclude no later than the top of the hour. So let's go with the Reverend Bruce Ballantyne-Jones. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you, everybody. I wondered if anybody would turn up but when they saw my name, but anyway, thank you very much for being here. Churchill famously described the Soviet Union as a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And I sometimes think that the Diocese of Sydney is a bit like that. When people think about the diocese, they might think of its opposition to the ordination of women, its opposition to the ordination of practicing homosexuals and to so-called gay marriage. They note its occasional disagreements with the Anglican Church of Australia and more recently its prominent part in addressing divisions in world Anglicanism. Now, behind all of these is a resolute opposition to theological liberalism. This is the approach that seeks to fit Christianity into a secular worldview at the expense of biblical authority. Liberalism is seen in Sydney as the main cause of numerical decline in Anglicanism in England, in the US, and in parts of Australia. Whichever way you think of it, Sydney is one of the most distinctive Anglican dioceses in the world. Now, my book's called Inside Sydney, An Insider's View, etc. And the reason I call myself a diocesan insider goes back to 1959, when at the age of 17, I made a personal decision to become a Christian at the Billy Graham Crusade. That night, I turned up at St. John's Darlinghurst, and in 1963, I was elected to represent that parish in the Sydney Synod, making me its youngest member. Later, I entered Moore College and was ordained in 1971, and thereafter was a parish minister until I retired in 2006. I joined the Anglican Church League, the ACL, in 1970. The ACL is essentially a political party aimed at advancing evangelical influence in the diocese. For many years, I was its president. Other roles I filled were as editor of a newspaper called the Australian Church Record in the 1970s, a member of the Synod's Standing Committee, a member and until recently chairman of the Glebe Administration Board and of the Diocesan Secretariat, which is the administrative arm of the diocese. I was a canon of St. Andrew's Cathedral, a member of numerous committees and commissions, and represented Sydney at the General Synod of Australia for about 30 years. I think that sort of qualifies me as an insider. Now, as to the diocese itself, it comprises some 270 parishes and 400 churches, with a weekly attendance of around 80,000 people. The Parliament of the Diocese, or Synod, has created around 50 organisations to further its objectives, and every 3 years elects, by secret ballot, some 500 people to manage these bodies. Included among them are some 40 schools, a theological college with around 300 full-time students, and a large network of caring initiatives under the banner of Anglicare. As to its character, the diocese is unashamedly evangelical in theology. This means that it places the highest importance on biblical authority, godly living, and evangelism. About 95% of the parishes are led by evangelical ministers. As an Anglican community, it has undergone massive changes over the last 40 years. These cover the everyday experience of belonging to a local church and to the growth of its central functions. Of these changes, former Archbishop Jensen said, and I quote, "Most of our churches have altered beyond recognition in the last 25 years. Ecclesiastical dress has changed, architecture has changed, preaching has changed, music has changed, the content of services has changed." He says, "Failure to make these changes would have shown a preference for church culture rather than the gospel, for the outward rather than the inward, for elitism rather than universalism." A critic of Sydney Evangelicals, Professor Michael Horsburgh, described the ACL, this political party, and its supporters in this way. This was in the Bulletin magazine in 2001. "They may appear to be socially conservative in their rejection of the ordination of women and attitudes towards homosexuality, but it," the ACL, "seeks radical changes in the Australian church." And he writes, he recites some of the same changes mentioned by Jensen. I basically agree with Horsburgh. Now, by far the most interesting element to outsiders is its overt political culture. The Herald loves to write articles about this from time to time. This culture is very much a function of the secular nature of the denomination. Former principal of Moore College, Broughton Knox, gave the most coherent formulation of this secular character. He said that denominations are secular bodies set up for religious purposes. The church itself is to be identified with the local congregation, which meets together for prayer and praise and teaching and fellowship. Denominations, on the other hand, are trans-congregational man-made entities set up to assist local churches. Some denominations have a top-down and highly centralised form of government, such as the Church of Rome, but others have bottom-up structures with a weak centre, such as the Baptist denomination. The Sydney model is a bit of both. It has an archbishop and a synod, with clear separation of powers. As a matter of fact, Sydney operates very much like a state within a state. Its structure is not unlike that in the American Constitution. For example, the US has an elected president Sydney has an elected archbishop. Both have elected legislatures. Reflecting its secular character, Sydney Synod operates under Westminster rules. Both the president and the archbishop can veto legislation, and both have executive responsibilities which are subject to constitutional and legal constraints. Both legislatures create laws and pass money bills. Senior appointments are subject to approval by their respective legislatures, and both systems have their judicial arms. To be frank, it would be impossible for such bodies not to be political. In Sydney's case, like many secular bodies, this involves political parties, how to vote tickets, how do 800 people vote for 500 positions on all those committees, the formulation of parliamentary tactics, the use of propaganda, and the staging of special events to promote policies and advance political objectives. However, notwithstanding all these things, for the most part, these activities are undertaken in a spirit of cordiality. Unlike our parliaments, it is considered bad form to attack individuals or to be disruptive on the floor of synod. It is more a play the ball, not the man, game. And the result of all this political activity is that in the last 108 years since the formation of the ACL, Sydney Diocese has become overwhelmingly evangelical. In my book, I have tried to describe many of the great controversies of recent years and how political action was employed to bring about results. I don't have time to talk about them at this moment, and you can buy the book if you want to know. Now, even though I am a lifelong warrior for the evangelical cause and the Sydney cause, I don't want you to think that I am an uncritical apologist for the diocese. I think I'm as aware as anyone of its weaknesses and limitations. In the main, my criticisms in the book go mostly to matters of central administration following the growth of financial resources. Also, the underlying committee culture, which in some cases led to serious underperformance. The problems relating to the GFC and the failures surrounding the recent diocesan mission are examples which come to mind and which I deal with in my book. In reflecting on these difficulties and all the others over the years, I've tried to work out why a diocese with so many resources and so much talent always struggled to do the big thing when run from the centre. The explanation I've come up with is at three levels. The first is that all the operational entities, parishes and major institutions, are functionally independent of the centre. When I say the centre, I mean the synod and the archbishop and all that goes with them. But they're functionally independent of them. And except in exceptional circumstances, they cannot be told to do anything. The second relates to the two-headed nature of diocesan leadership, archbishop and synod. When they disagree, they can cancel each other out, as often we see in the United States when the president and the Congress are in deadlock. But sometimes they do agree, but they still find it difficult to make progress. Why? This brings me to the third level, namely the inefficient committee culture, which robs the centre of a sense of united purpose and the capacity to translate good intentions into good outcomes. Put it another way, volunteerism at the board levels, the absence of strong corporate memory, and sometimes unchallenged conflicts of interest combine to hinder best practice and good governance, leading to underperformance and reputational damage. Call that the Yes Prime Minister Syndrome. And in my book, I nominate a number of examples. However, notwithstanding these problems, I am against a more centralised, top-down structure. Instead, I advocate a proper auditing process to ensure that all organisations follow best governance practices at board and senior management level. Anyway, despite these shortcomings at the organisational level, I am glad to say that Sydney Anglicans continue to express the essence of the Christian gospel, both in their devotion to evangelism and in the extensive works directed towards the needy through bodies like Anglicare and the Archbishop's Aid programs. However, and this is really my final point, the key to the strength of the diocese is the health of the local church. Good ministers, well-trained and theologically informed lay leaders, a strong commitment to children and youth ministries, and a strong sense of purpose at the local level is the key to that strength. Well, there is a little of the Diocese of Sydney from an insider's point of view. I hope it helps to unravel the riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. I'll be happy to answer questions in due course. Thank you.
Many thanks, Reverend Valentine Jones. Before I call our next speaker, I should say thanks to Malcolm Kerr, who suggested this function tonight, and to Peter Curdy, who gave us an idea about it as well. So now the Reverend Andrew Semple.
I thank the Sydney Institute for this invitation to come and speak about, well, the Diocese of Sydney, where do you start? I will limit at least to the book that Bruce has written about the diocese and my comments to that. I could stray into many other areas. As Rector of St James King Street, I might add the parish on whose lands we are gathering this evening, I stand well outside the political machinery of the diocese. Although as Dean of Bathurst, and including being a member of the General Synod and as an army chaplain, I did have my fair share of involvement in church politics in the past. The popular view is that the church invented politics, released it into the wild, and then has been struggling to get it back into its cage ever since. Now, we certainly have shifted a long way from the time of Christendom, when we as the church had the upper hand, and we could make bishops come crawling to us for forgiveness, kings come crawling to them for forgiveness. It is now the other way round, and the bishops go crawling to the politicians for influence, and churches have become more adjuncts to the political parties. In the words of Sir Humphrey Appleby, who's been mentioned this evening, the bishops seem to want to talk about politics, and the politicians want to talk about moral issues. But I'm digressing before I get going. Bruce's book, Inside Sydney, is in part a candid expose of the inner workings of the diocese in recent times. It is also part apology in defence of the role of politics in the diocese, and it is part autobiography. This last aspect is not unsurprising among literate politicians who are keen to ensure that the records of their endeavours are correct. Bruce's writing style is, like his political style, blunt and honest. And I'm sure there are some current and former assistant bishops that are smarting from his critique, although there is perhaps one who is quite happy as being described as the ablest in the diocese, but we won't go there. Bruce's book covers the administration of the diocese over almost 60 years, and, which is coincidentally, the period of the greatest decline in church participation in Australia's history, from around 40% of the population to around 8% today. It also happens to cover most of my lifetime. When I grew up at Glenorie on the northwestern outskirts of the city, I was involved in the parish of Dural there, and to my current times now as the rector of St James. There's a long time I was away from Sydney in between. This book is a veritable general store of stories and anecdotes with something available for everyone. Goods with which to agree or disagree, items that may offend, dark secrets to be revealed, whitewash to cover up, and flannel to ensure we don't get too close to some of the embarrassing moments. I have enjoyed reading it, and I've learnt much from it. And I agree with much of what Bruce has said, particularly in his criticism of the administration of the diocese. It's been very helpful, and I'm hoping that many others in the diocese will find it a helpful insight as well. Bruce, as we've heard, summarises the culture of the diocese in the whimsical words of Winston Churchill's description of Russia, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. Now, I wonder if this is intended irony. For I would describe Russia as a calculating, controlling and aggressive state. And that may well apply to the politics of the Diocese of Sydney too. Nevertheless, I do think that to understand the culture of this diocese, we do need to go back a little further than the mid-20th century. And Bruce does this in his book, and it's very helpful. Of course, Sydney was established as a penal colony, and the Anglican Church had the privileged position, as being part of the established Church of England, to provide the chaplaincy for the settlement. Unlike the United States, which has a religious narrative based on the liberal ideals of freedom and equality for its beginnings, New South Wales was established on hierarchy and control, despite the humanism of Arthur Phillip. The early governors tended to see the role of the church as moral policemen, there to convict people of their wrongdoing, encourage repentance and reform, and, if possible, make people useful to society. Many of the Anglican chaplains, such as Samuel Marsden, relished this role, along with the moralistic monopoly that they had, especially having the Catholic clergy kept out for the first 30 years. But of course, the Anglican Church was never the established Church of New South Wales or Australia, although I suspect many of its members have never quite come to terms with that. By the mid-19th century, continued settlement of principally English, Scots and Irish convicts and immigrants came to, well, brought the curse of sectarianism to our lands. The political and ecclesiastical conflicts over status, property and social control between Anglican Bishop William Grant Broughton and Catholic Archbishop Bede Poulding and the Presbyterian minister John Dunmore Lang have become legendary. As a reflection of ethnicity and class, sectarianism became the single most powerful religious force in Australian history, and segued into national politics and social order well into the 20th century. As Bruce noted, during this time, the Diocese of Sydney took on a profound anti-Catholic position, especially drawing from the politics of Ireland. For example, the mid-20th century principal of Moore College and staunchly anti-Catholic Irishman, Thomas Chatterton Hammond, was Grand Master of the Grand Orange Lodge of New South Wales. The anti-Catholic fervour is still present in some quarters in the diocese, even today. It is also interesting to note that this anti-Catholic prejudice in the diocese transferred itself to the resident Anglican Catholics, including some of my predecessors at St James King Street, of which the memorialist controversy of the 1930s is an example. The Sydney diocesan narrative for those on the outside has been one of a narrowing position away from ecclesiastical diversity, resulting in a monoculture that leaves the diocese vulnerable to social change because of an inability to adapt. This is perhaps an achievement of the political machine in the Diocese of Sydney, if not an intentional one. Another religious strand that entered the Diocese of Sydney in the early 20th century that Bruce does not mention was the Plymouth Brethren, a conservative, nonconformist holiness sect that, despite its name, originated in Ireland. The Katoomba Convention, based on the English Keswick Convention, was established by the Brethren, Young and Deck families, who had married into the Sydney hierarchy, including the Lone and Knox families. Attendance at this convention is a bit like a Russian party congress. It has become a way of defining who is sound, who is one of us. It also provides a way of teaching the Sydney narrative both across the diocese and across generations. And it gives young people the opportunity to meet each other and find suitable partners. As I have discovered through my own connection with the Young family, most of us in Sydney seem to be related to one another. And herein lies a problem. I will contend that far from being a democracy based on the Westminster conventions and open to the whim of the electorate, the Diocese of Sydney is in fact run as a family business. A big one, perhaps similar to what Consolidated Press used to be under the Packers. The familial and tribal connections are vital to the operation of the diocese, along with the patronage of powerful leaders, both clerical and lay. It is these tribal connections based on a narrative that reinforces the idea of being God's elect that leads to hubris and error. There are moments when Bruce comes close to acknowledging this, but then out comes the flannel. I refer, of course, to the loss of around half of the diocese's financial assets in the global financial crisis of 2008. Indeed, more than $160 million. The real figure has never quite been disclosed, although I must say Bruce does give the whole a good airing in his book, but I think there's much more to it. After all, who was the whiz kid that came up with the idea of borrowing a pile of cash to buy equities as a way of increasing wealth in an organisation that does not pay tax and therefore cannot write off the interest costs against their tax liabilities? Now, I'm not a merchant banker, but I do know that margin loans are for rich people who pay too much tax and who gamble that the capital gains will outweigh the interest burden they face. Something not dissimilar to investing in the Sydney property market. We, I think, were conned by our own propaganda, our greed, and our insularity. The problem for the Diocese of Sydney, I think, and for much of the Anglican Church today, is a rising lack of competent people to oversee the governance and good managerial practice of its entities. Too often a preference is given to people who are in the tribe, who are one of us, or who are ideologically sound, rather than getting the best professional available. Moreover, having the same people sitting on boards and commissions at the strategic, operational and administrative levels of the organisation can be a disaster, as the Diocese of Bathurst loan scandal has proven. When it comes to our governance and operations, we would be better served by people who have a high degree of professionalism, competence, and an ability to be called to account for their failings. But tribalism works against this, and the global financial crisis fallout has never actually completely been called to account, or at least those who were the cause of it. Bruce's argument for the centrality of synod as being something similar to a national parliament in a liberal democracy breaks down when one realises that, unlike a nation state, the church is a voluntary organisation, and that people are free to engage as they wish and leave at will. Indeed, many Anglicans' experiences of synods is not so much a binding force, but a force for them to leave. And leave they have, not necessarily from the synod, but certainly from the church, and Bruce has pointed this out over the past 60 years. With regular church participation plummeting, or this regular general church participation plummeting from around 45% of the population in the 1950s to 8%, or possibly even lower today. We don't have the latest census statistics. Now, this is a drop of about 80%. Although the drop in those who claim to be Christian on the census has only dropped 30%. Now, that's a very interesting difference between those who are actually participating, a drop of 80%, and those who are claiming to be Christian in the census, a drop of 30%. We could speculate on that. Today, around 2% of the population are regular worshippers, and that is at least, say, once per month, in an Anglican church in Sydney. It's really much the same in Melbourne and in Brisbane. The difference is the age profiling between the Diocese of Sydney and the wider church. The wider church has a much older age profile. The Diocese of Sydney is concentrated, I think quite well, on ministry to younger people, and therefore there are more younger people, especially ministry to teenagers. But nevertheless, there are 98% of the population who are not part of us, or not participating in the life of the church. And that's a question for me too. What is going on here? I could talk further about the failure of the mission goal of 10% and the problem of a top-down approach to change. I could talk about how the church spends too much of its time talking to itself and not enough time engaging with the community in an open, honest and vulnerable way. I could talk about how the desire of a minority to maintain social control over the rest of the community leads to resentment and rejection. I could talk about the way the exercise of real politic in the church alienates people and betrays, I think, the gospel of Christ, a gospel of humility. And I think it also betrays a different concept of church that I actually hold, which is that of sacred community. A riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma, indeed. But I still can see calculating, controlling, and often aggressive could be one that is considered. And with a need especially for control. And that's where the Anglican Church League has been very effective. I would certainly say as an organisation it has performed well in that way, in control. But I need to leave it there, and it's up to you to ask the questions.
Well, many thanks to our two speakers for a great start to tonight. As I said earlier, the copies of Bruce Bellantyne-Jones' Inside Sydney, and Anne's got some copies down the back. And so we come to questions and discussion. I'm glad we got virtually to question and discussion tonight without anyone mentioning God, which I think was refreshing. I arrived in Sydney as a Catholic baptised Melbourne sinner, and I went looking for the Anglican Church and I don't think I ever found it. But what I thought I did find was a kind of Presbyterian church, sort of reminded me of a kind of Calvinist church. And of course the old Presbyterian church, most of it had wound into the Uniting Church in 1977, but I thought much of it I saw here. So can someone just, both of you, just talk briefly about what you regard as the theology of the Anglican Church? I mean, is it a Calvinist Presbyterian church, or is it more like the Anglican Church that we're aware of in Melbourne or Brisbane or, of course, in England and Wales? So let's start with you, Bruce, then we'll go to Andrew, then we'll go to other questions.
Well, in terms of its theology, it is certainly Calvinistic. You only have to read the 39 articles. I have a copy of them in the prayer book here. The funny thing is that the Anglican system is a bit of a hybrid, because it went to Reformed theology, mostly Reformed theology at the Reformation, under the influence of Calvin and Martin Bucer and so forth. But because of the control of the state in England, it maintained the structure of the old church with bishops, etc. So it's a bit of both. But the difference between, say, the Anglican Diocese of Sydney and, say, Melbourne or these other places is that in terms of its basic theological orientation, it hasn't changed. But in terms of the way it expresses it, it has changed, as Peter Jensen and I myself in my book say, it's changed enormously, more changes in the last 25 years than in 200-300 years. And if I might just take one point from Andrew's, the changes have been directed or are responses to trying to position our churches to better contact their local communities. That's why they've got rid of a lot of the old medieval or other liturgical structures and become much more common. And so that's what I'll say.
Just stay here, and you can operate on that side.
What is the Anglican Church? It's a very good question. It's had several iterations over time. Obviously, the prayer book and the 39 articles are formative documents in this. I would certainly look to the Elizabethan settlement as a way of understanding it. What occurred before then was really a lot of politics. Henry VIII never really considered himself anything but a Catholic, even though an excommunicated one. His son Edward was not on the throne for all that long, and of course then came Mary and everything changed. So if anything, it was the Elizabethan settlement that gave some basis for what was going to be the Anglican Church. And Elizabeth and her ministers are rather clever. They described a Reformed Catholic Church, and so it's a two-way bet. And I think you probably find that most of the Anglican churches fits into that Reformed, but also Catholic. We see ourselves as part of a longer tradition, and certainly as the church in England, a tradition that goes back to, say, at least the 3rd century, possibly the 2nd century, as we try to work out where the first Christian or when the first Christian came to England and established the first church. So we don't deny what is the Celtic Church and what was the early Latin Church in Britain. We would hold that as being a part of the Anglican Church. So we don't necessarily look at the Calvinist reforms for our origin, although there is Calvinism within the Anglican Church, I would agree with that, but there's a whole lot of other things as well. And its diversity through its history has been one of the most effective ways of it, its capacity to operate and adapt. My concern is we don't seem to quite have that same ability today, because we keep expecting other people, wherever they may be and around the world, to be like us, and then things start to break down.
Just stay where you are. Okay, so there's a question here. Yep.
In Jesus' ministry, he appears not to have put doctrinal tests on his followers, and his longest recorded prayer in the Gospel of John is that his followers should be one, as he and the Father are one. In that context, I wonder why the Diocese of Sydney places such emphasis upon doctrinal correctness, in their view, to the exclusion of many people who would be confessing Christians who acknowledge Jesus as Lord, but cannot quite accept the nuances of the Sydney Anglican interpretation of evangelical theology.
Okay, Bruce, let's start with you.
Okay, well, I think that Christianity is a faith based upon a book called the Bible. And the Bible sets out God's word on what to believe and how to live. And it's quite dogmatic in both areas. And we believe that the Anglican Church at the Elizabethan settlement and following, and I could quote the articles, I have them here in my prayer book, laid down the principle that what, and I quote, whatsoever is not found in or can be proved thereby from the scripture is not to be believed. It takes the biblical authority seriously. And whether we like it or not, that is the word of God. It's not for us to choose this or that, or to devalue this or that. It's God's word. And Jesus, of course, taught that as well. Now, with respect to the question of, you talk about all in one and so forth and so on. Well, the church is a very fallible institution. It's made up of people like you and me. We all have our sins and wickedness and weaknesses, and we don't always get everything right. And people go off in tangents, and that's the nature of things. But you're quite right that people should try to express the duty of love for one another. But in most cases, that is in the with the people you know in your local church. And, of course, that's where you express it. Otherwise, it's a bit ethereal and academic. And so I think the emphasis I'd want to put is that we express our duty to love in helping the needy, in having fellowship and caring for one another we know, and supporting those causes which generally promote or advocate that kind of principle.
Okay. Do you want to respond to that?
Just one issue. Well, there's two. The first one is the issue of hermeneutics, which is the interpretation of texts, not just biblical hermeneutics, but it applies to the law and a whole lot of other things. And how you interpret the Bible is the issue here. If you can interpret it literally, if you want, but there's many other ways of interpreting, and I think that leads often to different conclusions. When you try and contextualise the Bible, firstly in its own culture as much as you can, we can't do that fully, and also then to interpret what does it mean in our own culture. The second point is the problem of denominations, which I think is one of the scandals of the church in our own time and has been for many centuries, not one that's easily going to be gotten rid of, but I'm a bit of a heretic. I actually see that they're a part of the problem and not part of the solution.
Jay, you really go behind. Just speak up.
Yeah,
you've got to be
oh,
brief.
Yes.
A lot of people.
I don't think I need a microphone. Jay Basick. I'm an outsider. I'm a retired Churches of Christ minister. So, in a room, must be an Anglican night because of serving wine.
But
very thoughtful.
It is older wine. We stole it.
I came tonight because I respect both of these gentlemen who I know in different venues. Bruce didn't say this, but he was the Council of Churches president for a number of years and was a bit of a rabble rouser, as he still is. I'm pleased to say I was at St. James on Easter Sunday, and had there been an altar call, Pastor, I would have come forward.
There almost was. I thought there was.
Yeah. Now let's get to the point.
The question is, with the churches going down in terms of official church attendance, there are pockets of church growth here and other parts of the world which are astonishing. I mean, what can the Church of England, which somebody once described as the Conservative Party of Prayer, we've all heard that one before, what can they do to arrest the minds and the hearts of people who I think are crying out for hope and faith?
Yeah. A couple of quick responses.
I think the key, there are plenty of churches and Anglican churches in Sydney which are very large and growing. The one I was rector of until I retired in 06 was a very large church, about 700 members, in a little place like Como Genoa. The key is this. If you want churches to grow, you have to have a message which will capture people and appeal to them in terms of what God's word is offering, which means you have to have well-trained and able ministers to lead local churches, which are like the local lighthouse for these messages. And so ministers are first. Get good ministers and you've got a chance. Second, you do have to, and I'm glad that Andrew made the point, you do have to put a lot of emphasis on young people, because most people who became Christians did so when they were young. The Anglican Church around Australia has basically given that game away, not in Sydney. And if we focus on young children and young people and young adults and they become Christians, you basically got them for the next 50 years. So that's your basis for ongoing support.
I don't disagree with Bruce. I think training clergy is really quite vital. I'm particularly disappointed that much of the Anglican Church outside of the capital cities has given up on training any clergy, and that's their big mistake. I'd prefer to get rid of the bishops and keep the trainees myself. Yes, you can. You can. Because I think that there's more value in training good new clergy. The other is the ministry to young people. But I would also go into the area of community engagement. I think that's really quite vital at the moment. I see that. Well, I had a friend who once described the church as a lager, and that is the wagons in the circle, and you're all on the inside, and the bad guys are on the outside, and you're looking outwards trying to protect yourselves, and I think that's often what we are.
Robin, we don't have a lot of time. We've got to be quick. Robin there and there. Yeah, Robin?
Yes, I'm completely outside of all of this.
You've got to be brief.
Oh. But there must be something surely wrong with the governance. I don't know, can't pretend to know what it is, when you have such a monolithic, non-pluralist, for the most part, excluding places like St. James, institution which differs so radically from Anglicanism in the rest of the world. I could not believe it when I went to Cambridge and found that it was so unlike Sydney, so refreshingly unlike Sydney. And I think some far more basic questions than the intricacies of the politics need to be addressed, and actually addressing adults, older adults, middle-aged adults, not just grabbing people while they're young and vulnerable. Anyway, I've been brief.
I'll pay you later.
Let me just point out this, that at the last Lambeth,
we talked the whole room,
at the last Lambeth conference in 2000 and whenever it was, 8, the leadership of 75% of world Anglicans did not attend Lambeth. They attended another conference in Jerusalem called GAFCON. And that's going to be the same next time. So that the idea of a monolithic Anglicanism is a bit of a fiction. And the parts of the Anglican Communion which are growing in the Third World and in places like Australia and other places were part of the people who didn't go to Lambeth, they went to GAFCON. So it's a complicated question. I agree with you that the Anglican Church in England, Australia, America is in big trouble. But it's not, as somebody said over here, it's not uniformly in trouble. So you ought to ask the question, where it's working and growing, what is it about that that makes the difference?
Okay, there's a question down the back there. Yeah.
Sure. At Glenn Davies' first synod, Peter Lynn stood up and talked about church attendance. And in Sydney, it tracked up until 2001. It followed community growth. And then it went resolutely down when around the world, anecdotally during the GFC, people were coming back to the church. And you said that Sydney believes that theological liberalism is the heart of decline, and we've been resolutely opposed to it. So it didn't work.
So okay, so the suggestion is that...
What do you think went wrong?
Okay, just so people pick it up. The suggestion is...
The mic?
Yeah, no, sorry. It's not working. Just a minute. The question is, after 2001, having gone up, church attendances went down, and the proposal is that maybe this was due to the theological position of the Sydney Archdiocese.
No, I don't think it's what you remember was said. I can't quote that, but the attendance didn't go down. It still tracked population. What was the problem was it didn't go up despite all the additional effort of the so-called mission.
I've still got the paper.
Okay, we've got it. Well,
I could add
the numbers
to that. Yep. The in the last 10 years, I do the statistics, I'm a stats guy. 10 years ago, the regular Sunday attendance of Anglicans in Sydney was about 1.3% of the population. It's now just under 1%. So it's a slight drop, but it's a percentage of population. The raw figures can go up, but as a percentage of population, there's been a slight fall.
Okay, well, there's a dispute about the figures, so I can't handle that. There's a question here. Yeah.
Bruce, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, where the money's spent and where the money's going. Truckloads of money in Sydney have gone into Moore College, which is creating a lot of, dare I say it, and I don't want to offend too many people, but very mediocre talent coming out. They do not have a terrific education there, and nobody seems to have the courage to improve that position.
A suggestion: too much money has gone into Moore College, and it's producing mediocre outcomes. Yep, there you go.
Well, what I think, they come out very well educated in terms of their degrees. I don't think that can be argued against. But in my opinion, what doesn't happen is that they don't come out well equipped for the hard work of parish ministry. And there's never been a clear philosophy of training at Moore College or in the diocese generally as to how to produce leaders, right? Because you can have well-trained theologians who are boring to hear, listen to, and don't know how to lead their congregations. And that's where I was alluding to before about the importance of good, effective ministers. That's the problem. It's been a problem for a long time. And I can only agree with you, Susan, on that. And I've tried my bit.
You're going to fix it.
Okay. Do you want to respond to that?
Only to a degree.
Okay, we'll do it to a degree. There's a suggestion no women or something. Could that be right? Okay. Do you want to respond? I'm handling that.
Which comment am I responding to?
I don't know. I thought, okay, you don't. That's fine.
No women.
No women.
No women priests.
No women
you're referring
priests.
To. Yes, well, that's a unique position that the diocese has taken over against the rest of the Anglican Church, except in a few small pockets. I think that's a part of the imbalance in the church, but it is based on a theological proposition about male headship. And I think that too is problematical, and as part of the alienation of the church from the wider community.
So do you want to respond to that? But you've got to be brief.
Yes. Well, I think that you'll find that there are more women proportionately in frontline and public ministries in the Diocese of Sydney than anywhere else. Certainly they're not ordained as presbyters to lead parishes, but there are many women deacons in parish ministry. And there are many lay women who are exercising powerful ministry. Only last weekend, there were tens, I don't know how many thousands there were at the Darling Harbour Conference for Women, right? Led by women and coming from all the churches. And so I think it's a bit of a myth to say that women don't get a fair go in Sydney. They get a very good fair go. It's just that the particular function of head of a congregation is not one of them.
We're going to wind up with two quick questions. It's got to be quick. There's one there and there's one there. You come back.
The analogy between the Synod in Sydney and parliamentary procedure in Westminster procedure has been made several times tonight. To me, there's one basic error in that analogy, which is that the people who are sent from the parishes to participate in Synod include people who are appointed by the Archbishop. Now, I've been involved in that process in a number of Sydney parishes over the years, and in the days when this diocese was more pluralistic and where there were parishes of charismatic background, of liberal background, of Anglo-Catholic background, those parishes sent people along to synod who represented the views of the parishioners. In recent times, it's become more and more the case when those parishes become vacant, And when those parishioners, through their elected representatives, put up names to the Archbishop to replace them, they are not given the people they wish for. They're given the people, law college trained people who represent just one particular
We've got to move on. The suggestion is, I guess, that the Senate's sort of stacked by people who are going to favour the line of the Archbishop here, through the parishes.
Well, it's true in Sydney, and it's true in every other diocese, only the balance is reversed. You go to Brisbane, you go to Adelaide, you go to Perth, it's the same monochromatic character, only it's the evangelicals that are on the outer there. So it's not a Sydney issue, it's a universal issue in a polarised congregation.
You want to respond, then we're going
Yes, I think a monochromatic institution is dangerous for the institution because it restricts its ability to adapt to new circumstances and do new things, and I think that any diocese is suffering from that problem. It's not just Sydney, but I'd agree that, as Bruce says, other dioceses have a similar problem. There's a basic principle that you need diversity to be able to change and adapt.
Final question?
Doug McLennan. Bruce, you mentioned the decline of, 80% in the last 60 years in the local church.
No, I didn't say that.
No, it's across
I did.
The diocese.
He said that. I don't agree with what he said, but he said it, not me.
You guys should talk to one another.
Oh, there's census statistics I work on.
Okay.
But given that, and given that we presume that the quality of graduates coming out of Moore College are tilting at being competent, what's the role, you mentioned youth, what's the role of lay people, that is, equipped saints within the local church? What are we going to do in the local church?
Okay, what's the role of the laity in
the
local church?
The role is to get them involved at preaching, teaching, leading. Absolutely. In my parish at Genally, we had 70 small groups. Over 500 people attended those weekly Bible studies. The clergy in my staff, we only did, between us, about 15. Who did all the others? It was lay people.
So is that one of the missing ingredients in the...
Well, I don't think it's so much missing in Sydney, but you might check some of the other areas, because I think whatever it is in Sydney, it's more lay people involved in Sydney than in other parts.
A perspective from your church, Father.
The laity of the church. The laity do the ministry. Bruce needs to get out a bit more and see what happens in a few places, but in Bathurst I had a large number of lay people busily performing ministry of a wide range of varieties. And that is what the church needs to be. And I actually think that is one of the big changes that has occurred during the latter half of the 20th century, a good thing, that the laity have been liberated a bit more to do ministry. My concern, actually, in Sydney with the mission is that it was a top-down approach, and we actually should have turned it right around, and it should have been something that the laity was driving rather than the Archbishop and the clergy and everyone else. And the mistake was to say, let's sort out the clergy and then everyone else will follow. Well, they didn't.
Well, I think we ended on a degree of unanimity, I think. So I think we did. Thanks to the Reverend Bruce Ballantyne-Jones and to the Reverend Andrew Semple. It's been a great discussion tonight, a very fair discussion, but a lively discussion. I've learned a lot about the Anglican Church, the reflections of its links, its links to Calvinism, its links to Catholicism, and the various moods in between, and what's been going on here in the Archdiocese of Sydney since 1966, and we went before 1966 as well. So I found it a very valuable discussion. Anne will be publishing the papers in the Sydney Papers online. The discussion will be up on our podcast tomorrow. We could go all night, but I've got to get to benediction, so I can't hang around. So, and it's nice to finish on this note with everyone still here and firing. So many thanks to Bruce Ballantyne-Jones. All the best wishes with your book, and to Andrew Semple, all the best wishes with your church.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.